Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Shirley Min.
And I'm Delaware Public Media's Tom Byrne.
You're listening to Ask Governor Meyer. This monthly series is a chance for Delawareans to hear directly from their governor and ask questions in real time. Delaware Governor Matt Meyer, thanks so much for being here in our Philly studio.
Thanks, Shirley. Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So we are going to move through many pressing issues in this hour, from education to healthcare to affordability, and we would love to include listener questions and comments in the mix. You can join the conversation by calling 888-477-9499, emailing askgovmeyer@whyy.org, and if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, just drop your comment in the chat.
Okay, Governor, we're going to start with some news that's unfolded over the past few days. Our colleague, Sarah Mueller, reports that you removed Michael Houghton from the Delaware Economic and Financial Advisory Council, DFEC for short. This comes just 2 days after Houghton told WHYY News that he was concerned about the lack of corporate tax revenue data provided by your administration. What is going on here?
Yeah, listen, if I was elected on any principle, it was that Delaware is a government for everyone. We are a democracy. We are a participatory democracy. There are hundreds of boards and commissions to which I appoint people. When I came into office last January, 14 months ago, one thing we did is we started an exhaustive review of all boards and commissions. There were many people on there that were there for years and years. And we said, just for the sake of our state, let's get new blood on there. DFAC, the Delaware Financial Advisory Committee, very important committee that makes revenue projections and financial projections for our state and putting together our budget. We overhauled it, put a new chairperson in. Mike Houghton was the chairperson for 8 years, starting in January of 2017. Almost everyone on DFAC, or many people we actually took off DFAC, those who'd been there for, some had been there over a decade. Mike Houghton, we were going to remove him, but we decided what made sense in the interest of transition was keeping him on for a few months. He was the former chairman. We're not removing him because he did a terrible job. We just want new blood on there. He'd been in there over a year, and so it was time to remove him. Any link to anything? I mean, he spoke at the latest DFAC meeting. If you know Mike Houghton, he speaks at most DFAC meetings.
Mm-hmm. But I was going to say, a number of lawmakers have weighed in on this, saying that they were concerned about the optics, that something was said in an article earlier this week, and then a couple of days later, I mean, what do you say to them?
I don't govern for optics. I govern for people, and I govern to deliver for people. And with regard to that, the crazy allegation that we're doing something funny with numbers, the allegation is based on us doing something different in reporting corporate finance revenue in March DFAC. What has not been reported is that the March 2026 DFAC meeting, the meeting a few days ago, reported no change in corporate revenue from December to March. And that's the big controversy. Why is there no change? Are corporate franchises doing so well according to what the governor is saying? What is not being reported is in March of 2025, there was no change reported. In March of 2024, there was no change reported. In March of 2023, there was no change reported. We're doing what is done in the ordinary course of financial reporting. The reason is because though the year ends December 31st, the payments are due for many LLCs and corporations March 1st. It takes time. The final numbers always come in May DFAC, and they'll be reported in May DFAC. The bottom line for Delawareans is, number one, we're going to work no matter what upheaval there is or insider games. We're going to work tirelessly to make sure boards and commissions and every arm of government in which I have any say is representative of the diversity of the people, and people cycle through, get new blood. And that's the first thing. And the second thing people should know is that a year ago, you know, when I was hearing from you and getting questions, it was about an existential threat to our corporate franchise, about a third of our budget. And today, a year later, our corporate franchise is healthier than ever before. The number of entities, new entities formed in 2025, up 15.4%, 2.2 million entities in Delaware, more entities per capita than any state in the country. The Tulane Corporate Law Institute last week, this is what should have been reported, at the Tulane Corporate Law Institute last week, which is the leading meeting of corporate decision makers in deciding where to incorporate a company on key corporate governance issues. I wasn't there, but my phone was blowing up. It was a Delaware love fest. People are like, Delaware is back, the place to incorporate your company and grow your company.
So two quick clarify questions. why not keep Haddon on just through the rest of the budget cycle? Like, why choose now to cycle him off? Why not just leave him on there for that continuity transition?
Because the transition is done, Tom. We're 14 months in. And I think that there is, at the heart of the issue, Tom, is in a small state like Delaware, some people feel very entitled. They feel like I was put in this seat by a governor, four governors ago, right? Not the case of Mike Houghton, but others. And I've been here, and who are you to take me out? Well, I don't report to you. I report to all the people. And my obligation to the people of the state is to make sure that there's diversity, not to govern for optics or this, or there's this news article, so I'm not. That's not how I govern. We're going to do what's best for the people. We're going to make sure information is accurate, that the people there have the right expertise, the diversity of expertise. DFAC is in a great place, and we're looking forward to the numbers.
And finally, on the numbers themselves, you expect in the May DFAC numbers to have fully updated numbers, and you expect to see stronger numbers based on these things you've just talked about.
I've learned with that. You don't know there. So what I'm talking about is the number of entities, right?
Okay.
In terms of how much money came in per entity, whether that's gone up or down. So I don't know at a level where I'm going to say expect it to go way up. I know the December number was good, increased the projection for both this fiscal year and next fiscal year. In May, I don't know, but my pledge to you and to the people of my state is they're going to get accurate end-of-year numbers, just like they do every May.
Okay, Governor, we're going to turn now to education. So as a former public school teacher, you know as well as anyone that the challenges that are facing Delaware schools. Last year, you declared a literary emergency after national test scores revealed eighth-grade reading scores hit a 27-year low. So recently, your administration unveiled a new strategic plan. Part of it is getting third grade reading proficiency up from 38% to 53% by 2028. So that feels like a big jump. Yep. Is that realistic?
We'll find out, won't we?
Yeah.
I like big, hairy, audacious goals. I did it in the private sector. I don't think the public sector should be any different if I'm reporting to the people of the state. Listen, I've taught. I started as a fourth grade teacher, and you stand in front of kids who are not getting the education that they deserve, that's not acceptable. It bothered me that as a teacher, that there were all these things that government and governors would treat as an emergency, but the literacy of kids, the mathematical numeracy of kids was not often one of them.
Well, then what's the plan to get there?
The plan to get there is it's not something that I can reduce to a single talking point. We're paying a lot of attention to the minutia, the details of classroom instruction. You don't move from 38 to 53%, make a 15% jump in a couple of years with grand strategies. It's more than anything about executing, making sure we understand where are the gaps, what schools are at single digit proficiency. Can we get them up to 20, 25% proficiency, which, to be honest, to me sounds totally unacceptable, but it'd be a huge step in progressing forward. So I also know from teaching every school, every district, every classroom is a little bit different. Every teacher needs something a little bit different. That's why you might know I supported this Teachers Choose program that got individual funding based on what a teacher wanted, teacher discretion over funding. Mm-hmm. I think things like geared towards literacy, I think that helps. I think software that we're looking at helps. And also making sure, here's another trick we're really looking at. Teachers are used to giving standardized tests at the beginning of the year and then standardized tests at the end of the year. You give a standardized test in September and you get the results maybe in November. You do a standardized test in May and you get the results maybe in July or August. That May test is completely not useful at all in educating students because they're already no
longer. It's an autopsy.
Tests. Right. It's an autopsy. Exactly. So we're working on getting effective interim assessments. That does not mean kids are going to be sitting once a week and doing standardized tests, but using software and the latest, greatest technology, not just bits and bytes, not just digital technology, but also curricula and teacher technology to get regular progress reports so we're not waiting to the end of the year. So you can see October, November, December, this classroom is not going in the direction we want. We need to change something now.
There was a lot of angst maybe like 10 years ago about state testing and teachers feeling pressure because of state testing goals, making sure those proficiency numbers were hitting the benchmarks. Do you worry about that kind of returning? The teachers start to think, oh my gosh, we've got to hit these numbers or else.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, education, it's not the filling of a pail. It's William Butler Yeats. It's not the filling of a pail. It's the lighting of a fire. So when it comes to individual classroom instruction, it's really important kids get the skills that they need. But it's also important there be a certain culture and environment in that school that fosters a lifelong learning, that even if a student does not get proficient, they can leave the class with their head held high, saying, I'm a smart kid and I'm okay. And even a teacher that struggles with a class that's really hard says, we're going to be okay.
We have a comment from David on Facebook, and he writes, it's not the teachers, it's not the schools, it's the homes and culture. So how can we encourage more parents to have more buy-in in their kids' education?
It's a great point. I don't necessarily agree that you say it's all on the teacher or all on the home or all on the school administration. I think it's a little bit of both. I think there are places to improve in all of those. We're looking at parent engagement in schools. There's a lot of research that shows that when there's reading and a literacy environment at home, the reading scores go up, the literacy scores go up in school. So we're seeing what we can do also to engage parents in literacy activities and also obviously engaging them as much as possible in their kids' education.
Just wanted to ask the one more question about accountability. Like, who is accountable if these targets are not met?
Well, my Secretary of Education is certainly accountable. The accountability measures currently available to us are not what they need to be. What I'm saying is, as we look to funding reform, which I think you referenced and maybe we'll talk about, as we look to funding reform, changing funding, we got to make sure that taxpayers are getting fair value for what they're doing, and we'll find ways to do that.
So I want to turn now to one of the more heavily debated issues around schools. That's the proposed plan to consolidate the four Northern New Castle County school districts into one. That is something you've been supportive of, but now the group working on it, the Reading Consortium, says it needs more time to deliver its plan of action, basically pushing things back into 2027. First off, do you support moving that deadline back?
Yeah, people know that I'm a rusher. If it's not done by yesterday, I want to know why not. And I think this is a case where the why not kind of makes sense. When you talk about district consolidation, it's a very complex problem. It's a complex math and financial problem. It's a complex problem in terms of busing and school assignment. And it's a complex problem in terms of human resources and all sorts of other issues. Before we move forward, there are a lot of questions unanswered. So I think it's important we do take time to study it. And to be frank, I think when you talk about school consolidation, I've come out and said this is a good idea and something we should support. I understand that school consolidation can be done in a way that's really effective for Northern New Castle County and really improves public education for many kids. It also can be done in a way that's really destructive and really hurts kids. I go back to an old adage that Senator Carper would say, and that is, in a complex system, look and find what's working. If there's a good classroom, if there's a good school, let's do more of that. And if there's a classroom that's not working, a school, a district that's not working, let's do less of that.
What do you say to families who are anxious about what redistricting means to them? That without clarity, there's a vacuum that's filled with worry.
Yeah. I think that's fair, and I think it's one big reason why we take time to study it. We take those viewpoints into consideration. Now, there's some fear with change, right? I have two kids in Brandywine School District and a third kid who likely will go to Brandywine School District. This is something immediate, and Brandywine is one of the districts we're talking about that will be involved in the consolidation plan. It's immediately relevant to me and my life, just it is to many parents out there. So we're going to take their input into consideration. We're not going to just reject something out of fear or out of imagining the worst possible outcome. We're going to be honest with each other and see what we can do to improve education for everyone, public education for everyone across Northern New Castle County.
Staying on the subject of education in Wilmington, during last month's Department of Education budget hearing, it was noted that the Wilmington Learning Collaborative would receive substantially less money in your budget plan, dropping from $10 million this year to $2 million. 80% less funding. Is that an indication that collaboration may not have a long-term future, especially if consolidation goes forward?
That the learning collaborative...
The Wilmington Learning Collaborative,
If there's... I think we'll need to rethink a lot of that if there's consolidation. The Wilmington Learning Collaborative, when we looked at it in my budget, had reserves of, I think,
it would take them up to $4 million, but they'd still lose about $6 million.
Right, but they had, based on the rate at which they are spending money right. this year and last year, they would have enough money through the next fiscal year. Now, between when we announced our budget and the budget hearings, my understanding is there were some changes made in how they spend money. So I don't know if that's true any longer. But the bottom line is this. If the schools are consolidated, that still leaves a big question of what happens to kids in Wilmington. Are kids in Wilmington going to get lost? Right now, one of the problems that was highlighted by the Reading Consortium is that I forget that it's kids in Wilmington, which is not Philadelphia. It's 70,000 people live there. Kids there go to something, I think over 40 public schools, an incredible number of public schools. And the overwhelming majority of them are bused outside of the city, often out to Christina High School, past Newark Bear, to really far places to go to school. And so the Wilmington Learning Collaborative, I think, is doing a good job in focusing on, okay, what do Wilmington students need? And that's going to be something, regardless of what's in the budget this year, that's going to be something that needs continued focus.
Okay, before we hit a break, I want to do a couple listener questions if we can squeeze it in. Cynthia from Milford writes, is Delaware investigating other methods of saving our sand beaches besides replenishment?
That is an excellent question. Yes, is the short answer. There are things that we can do in terms of buffering roads. A lot of it has to do with the built environment. That in over the course of decades, there's a lot of land in which water would seep into that now is non-permeable or semi-permeable. Mm-hmm. Our Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control has been working for about a generation with the federal government on various agencies of the federal government with preservation efforts outside of beach replenishment. We are really taking a microscope to that with the changing relationship with those federal agencies, making sure the state takes on that mantle.
Okay, hear the music. We need to stop it there for just a moment, but we will be right back with more from Delaware Governor Matt Meyer, including his take on rising hospital prices and ongoing concerns about data centers.
And you still have a chance to make your voice heard. Call 888-477-9499. Email askgovmeyer@whyy.org. If you're watching on YouTube and Facebook, drop your comment in the chat. This is Ask Governor Meyer.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
Okay, you're listening to Ask Governor Meyer on WHYY and Delaware Public Media. I'm Shirley Min.
And I'm Delaware Public Media's Tom Byrne. With us live in our Philadelphia studio is Delaware Governor Matt Meyer.
Okay, and he's taking questions from us and from you this hour. If you have a question or comment, email askgovmeyer@whyy.org or call in at 888-477-9499. Okay, we're going to stay on the topic of money and education. Delaware's current school funding model can be dizzyingly complicated. It's an understatement. The Public Education Funding Commission is preparing to vote on a new model next month. So, Governor, what would the new plan do and why is it necessary?
Well, the current funding formula is the oldest funding formula in America of any state. It was written in the 1940s. Now, take a minute and think about what public education was like in the 1940s, what the values of those people who designed that formula was. You can imagine the inequities and structural problems with a system like that. Schools were where students from wealthier backgrounds live, public schools, get much more funding per student than areas with lower income student. We want to make sure, and more important than the school, we want to make sure every student is getting funding according to their need. Because, and then, as I mentioned, once the funding formula is set, we make sure that there's accountability for those dollars, and the public is getting high quality education delivered for the dollars. So it's simplifying it. It's basically everybody's going to get a certain set dollar per student, mm-hmm. And then there are certain enhancements that if the student does not speak English as a second language, if the student has a special education need, they'll get each of these things, gets additional dollars for the student. And as the student, if a student moves from one district to another, mm-hmm. to a charter school, the dollars will go with them.
Are you optimistic it'll get done this year?
I've learned it's very hard to predict. I said when I came into office in January, I wanted something in 6 months. They took a huge step forward last year with a resolution saying, here are the principles. Mm-hmm. They followed those principles. So I'm as optimistic as I can be.
One of the recommendations the commission's considering is, and it raised some questions, was the idea of allowing districts to raise taxes to cover the cost of implementing the new model without a referendum. Do you support that, given the recent property tax reassessment changes that caused so much frustration?
Yeah, I think that my personal view, and we're working with the legislature to take steps forward on this. There is the current rule is that number one, there has to be a reassessment every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And number two, schools can raise revenue without a referendum at reassessment by 10%.
Right.
Right. I think it makes sense to get rid of that and say districts can raise revenue 2% or some, but based on some consumer price index, some inflationary index each year. If they want to raise more than that, they need to do a referendum. And if not, there's some reasonable amount they can increase by. I understand the challenge of districts right now that some districts are having real challenges getting a referendum passed. And to attract teachers, you can't pay the teacher the same amount every year for 5 years. Their salaries are going up and the district's got to find a way to get the resources to pay staff and teachers competitive prices.
So you would like to see like comprehensive referendum reform beyond this idea of just this very small sliver of like, okay, you can raise it just to handle the covering the cost of implementing the new funding formula.
I think we need to look at a funding of schools all around. And part of it is the funding formula, how we distribute money from the state to the 19 districts and charter schools. And we also have to look at how the money comes in and making sure it's fair across our state.
I do want to ask you real quick, because you've a couple of times said, oh, I've learned to be a little bit more patient on things.
Did I say that?
Kind of, sort of, right?
that was my wife speaking for me.
But has education reform, particularly the funding reform, proven more or a heavier lift than you expected?
No, I think we're going fast. I mean, they've been working at this for decades, Tom. This didn't start on January 21st, 2025 when I was sworn in. It's been going on for decades. And if you talk to people in the room, many of them have been doing this for over a decade. And we're very close. We're closer than we've been a long time.
Maybe not as fast as you would like, but fast enough.
I always want it by yesterday.
Governor Meyer, we want to turn to healthcare now. Delaware has some of the highest hospital costs in the country. A bill before the General Assembly, now SB1, would set a concrete limit on how much hospitals can charge for patients or can charge patients, among other things. Christiana Kara said this would hurt its ability to reliably deliver high-quality care. You mentioned last week at a press conference you're monitoring this bill. How critical is getting this or something like this done to address healthcare costs?
Look, I think every Delawarean deserves access to affordable, quality healthcare. We're working, we have a comprehensive plan that was announced 5-6 months ago to expand and protect access, to tackle costs and build out a healthcare workforce designed to meet the needs of today. There's a basic structural problem right now in Delaware, and Delaware's not alone in facing this, that the demographics of America right now with the boomer generation, they have needs for healthcare providers, and there simply aren't enough healthcare providers for what's needed. The consequence of that is in many communities in our state, people are waiting 6 months, 8 months to see a medical professional. So our plan includes doing things like there's a bill right now to change what's called scope of practice. So we're looking at what do physician assistants do? What do nurses do? What do pharmacists do? Are there things they can do to work as medical practitioners, say, truly to the top of their license that will enable the public to get high quality health services without needing to see a medically trained doctor. There are other things we're doing. You've probably heard me talk extensively about a medical school. We applied to the federal government and received more money than the state has ever received in any competitive grant program, $157 million to implement our plan. We've just started implementing our plan. We think we might be among the first states in the country to actually start spending the money. So we're excited about our plan. As I said, our ideas are not the only ideas. We took a lot of input in making the ideas, including input from the legislature. We're monitoring that bill. We like the legislative process. We're watching the input, and we'll see what happens.
So what other paths do you think, if not this bill, what other paths do you see that the state could do to help bring hospital costs down?
Well, you need to change a supply demand. One of the greatest drivers of hospital costs. Why does hospital cost so much? Because there's such a shortage of medical practitioners. There's huge shortages of nurses. Hospitals are often relying on what's called locums, which is among the most expensive doctors. It's almost like, I don't want to denigrate them because a lot of them are fine doctors, but like temporary doctors, mm-hmm. where they just come in. You have to pay them a lot of money, and you often have to pay an agency for them to come work. What we're trying to do in time, it takes time, but to get a lot of medical practitioners. Also making telemedicine, looking hard at the regulation around telemedicine. My wife, who's a medical practitioner, started to do work in Maryland, and it was incredible to me the amount of work she had to do to get Maryland licensure. I'm like, are Maryland bodies different than mm-hmm. Delaware bodies? Like, it's by and large the same practice. We're looking at cross-state to make sure when people want to come here and practice, we make it really easy and really fast.
We have a caller on the line. George from North Wilmington is on the call. George, what's your question? And thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question to the governor is, why are we seeing, and I'm specifically addressing North Wilmington, all these vape shops are being open in within 2 miles of each other on every corner of North Wilmington, whether it's Marsh Road, Silverside, 202. These stores are just poisoning our kids. And if the state is finding a way to just license them and give them licenses, they're just basically contributing to the degradation of our kids and addiction to smoking and vaping. I want to get off and listen to what the governor has to say.
Okay, George, thank you so much.
Thank you. I truly appreciate the question. When we looked at our budget this year, we found that there were a number of tobacco products that were not even being taxed or not taxed appropriately that are sold in places like vape shops. So one thing we did and we've gotten strong support from the Heart Association and Cancer Society, is making sure we effectively tax these things so that the cost to our communities and healthcare system is incorporated into the cost of the product. But George, in terms of the actual locations, I'm a strong believer in local control and local land use. Please speak to your local county government. Let's look at where they're doing these things and if we can change the laws to be more restrictive in terms of where these things go, and particularly to make sure that we're keeping kids out of those stores. That's really vitally important.
Okay, I want to bring in a couple of listener questions here on the same theme of healthcare. A physician wrote in to say that Delaware has an aging population, spends more per capita on healthcare than almost any other state, and relies heavily on Christiana care. Yet we struggle to retain physicians with too many young doctors like myself leaving after completing their training. And then George in Wilmington writes, my family doc of 15 years is closing, and now I can't get a new patient appointment for 12 to 18 months. So both in these cases are wondering if state government can be doing more. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so there's definitely a problem with private practices. That some of the problem when we talk about hospitals is the movement away from private, again, a national problem. We have a primary care collaborative that's working hard to make sure that primary care physicians are appropriately compensated for their work. And part of a legislative initiative that I'm very supportive of right now is how do we make sure that primary care providers, particularly in private practices, are compensated fairly. As anyone who really knows health specialties knows, the primary care practitioners are among the lowest paid of any health practitioners. And we need to, if we really want to emphasize primary care, we need to make sure we turn that on its head in Delaware. Mm-hmm.
So staying on the topic of this doctor pipeline in Delaware. You're planning to use federal grant money to start a new medical school in Delaware. Some lawmakers did raise some concerns about the long-term viability of the project once that federal funding disappears. How do you respond to that?
There will be substantial private money contributed to it. And done well with tuition resources, we should be in a good place. It sounds very similar to what I heard about the Hope Center when we started it back in 2020, that we shouldn't do this because you only have 2-3 years of money for it. In this case, we have 5 years of resources for the medical school. What happened with the Hope Center is there are all sorts of partnerships now that are helping to support it in addition to other federal funds. It's used very little, if any, county and local funds, and we expect the medical school to be similar.
But it will take a little time for to see a return on investment of that effort, right?
Sure. Yeah, of course, when you open a medical school, there are not going to be doctors on day one. It will take years for there to be doctors, and done well, it's going to be a huge, major asset, financial asset for Delaware and for communities across our state.
Can you say more about what you hope the program does for physician retention, especially in the more rural parts of our state?
So the medical school is one of 15 different projects in our healthcare proposal. There are other things like, as I mentioned, there are kiosks, health kiosks that we're going to be setting up that people can go to get primary care. Some of the technology now is pretty extraordinary that you can go into a kiosk, hit a button, and get often a doctor, sometimes a physician assistant or a nurse anywhere in the country who's appropriately licensed, who can provide you care. And something like that in a rural area where there's limited access can help in the short term until we get plentiful doctors in. We're also looking to expand residency slots. We're looking hard at where are their greatest health needs and are there enough residency slots. We do pretty well. I understand people anytime, like when a company leaves, even if the broader data shows that companies by and large are staying and coming, even if the broader data shows that residents who do residency in Delaware by and large are staying, if somebody knows a resident or somebody worked a couple years and left, they'll be like, oh my God, things are terrible. But we're looking to expand residency slots, particularly in underserved areas of our state, and putting incentives for people to stay there.
Ideally, you'd love the graduates to stay and be doctors in Delaware.
The good ones, yeah.
So we've got a listener question from Danielle in Sussex County. She says, has the state considered offering penalty-free early retirement for employees? Many employees who need to retire feel forced to stay due to penalties. I have over 20 years of service and need to care for a loved one but can't afford to retire under the current system.
Is that a state government employee, I assume?
Yes.
Yeah, we have not looked at early retirement programs just because I don't want all our great workers to up and leave and take a buyout. If someone's in a personal situation where they feel like they need to get out, we're happy to look at it on a case-by-case basis, see what we can do.
Okay, I want to just read a comment before we go to break. It was a YouTube comment that reads, why are you taxing us to death? School tax increases, property tax increases, DMV fee increases, sewer and water increases, energy increase, tobacco increases.
So, you know, what's interesting about that is that Delaware regularly is shown to have a lower tax burden than surrounding states. Of mid-Atlantic states, of the states in our region, we are the only state that's adding population. People are coming to our state from larger cities, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and the most common reason cited is the affordability. So I agree. We're constantly looking for how we can make our state more affordable. Saying that things are increasing here and there is not necessarily fair. We have not had a single income tax increase as county executive. I was the only county executive ever who reduced property taxes. So I'm proud of my record on that, and we'll continue to work hard to deliver affordability.
All right, Governor, we're going to pause there for now. In just a moment, we'll be back with Delaware Governor Matt Meyer, including more questions from you, our listeners. This is Ask Governor Meyer. You are listening to Ask Governor Meyer on WHYY and Delaware Public Media. I'm Shirley Min.
And I'm Tom Byrne. Joining this us this hour live is Delaware Governor Matt Meyer, and it is not too late to join the conversation.
Email askgovmeyer at whyy.org or call us at 888-477-9499. And if you're watching our live stream on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comments in the chat. So we're going to wrap up our conversation on the subject of healthcare by hearing from one of the reporters who's been covering Delaware at the ground level.
Yes, and to kick off this segment, which we're calling Reporter's Notebook, here's a dispatch from Delaware Public Media political reporter Benta Boutier.
Hi, Governor Meyer. Federal funding for Medicaid is set to decrease significantly over the next 10 years. Your budget proposal calls for about $140 million to grow services for the state, but some are saying that's not enough. During Joint Finance Committee hearings for Health and Social Services, about half of public comment came from home care workers or people who benefit from them, raising concerns. Here's Hope Scheiber. She helps care for her sister.
Families across Delaware are facing the same crisis. Caregivers are forced to quit jobs, retire early, exhaust savings, and provide complex skilled medical care themselves. Caregiver burnout is very real, and families collapse under the pressure, all because the authorized care at home is not being provided because there are no nurses available.
So I'm asking here what the budget does to invest in home care for families like Hope's.
Yeah, Benta makes a good point, as does the listener. We increased funding in the budget in accordance with something called the McNasby Act to enable those caring for people with disabilities to have an increase. And I was told that no governor has ever included that in their recommended budget. When dealing with a parent, a grandparent, a relative, a senior, it is a challenge. There are programs through Medicaid where family members can get funding. We're doing everything we can in a very, very challenging funding environment to continue that funding. And we will do what we can over time to increase the funding. We understand the pressure that family members are under. I have two aging parents. I'm lucky to be in a place where there's not really a financial crunch, but I get that a lot of families are crunched. I'm in, I think, what they call the sandwich generation, where I have a couple young kids, three young kids, and I have two aging parents. And trying to manage that is very challenging. And I recognize there are a lot of people who are seeing not just a time crunch, but a financial crunch. And we need to do everything we can to make resources available to them. You got to understand the crunch we're under, a federal government that now is working hard to cut every corner and cut every dollar on Medicaid, doing it when they're suddenly finding billions and billions of dollars every day to go and fight an unnecessary war that's increasing costs across my state and across the country. So the best and most realistic solution is if the federal government starts turning around and funding these things. If not, we as a state need to keep our head down and find a way.
I want to move on now to another favorite topic of listeners, and that is data centers. A proposed facility near Delaware City was rejected under the Coastal Zone Act by DENREC, state agency that oversees natural resources and environment. The company behind it appealed, argued its case this week. It was rejected today, that appeal.
Unanimously.
Your reaction to that decision and kind of where things stand with.
I think it's the right decision. I mean, I'm a fan of Governor Peterson and the Coastal Zone Act. I think if you want to, as I've said on the show before, if you want to set up something with over 500 diesel generators, keep in mind, I believe the largest sort of diesel generator user right now in Delaware, I believe, is Christiana Hospital that has, I think, three or four diesel generators. They want over 500 diesel generators in the coastal zone. That's not acceptable. That's precious land, and we need to preserve it. I appreciate that our Department of Environmental Resources, under the leadership of Greg Patterson, said no, and I appreciate that upon appeal, his case was universally upheld, or his decision was universally upheld.
Even with this win, what more are you hoping to see accomplished short-term to address some of these data center concerns that numerous people have raised?
Yeah, I've been very clear about our standards with data centers. The first is any data center, quite frankly, any power user who comes online, any large power unit user, cannot increase the cost for families in our state, their energy bills, by a single dollar. They cannot. That's not what they're there for. I made very clear they should be, these data center users should be working to actually add power to the grid, not take away from it. That's the first thing. And second, there are very serious environmental risks to data centers with their use of water. And before any data center will be approved, we need to make sure that they're appropriately addressing water sustainability needs in communities.
In addition to the data center, you know, we've talked ad nauseum about the electric rates and the bills going up. And I wanted to just touch on this comment from Dan from Milton. So he asks, how can we lower electric rates in Delaware? Are there solar incentives that can sell power back to the grid after powering our home? And I thought we do have some of this solar renewable energy credit system.
We do. There's, in fact, a net metering bill. I just signed one bill on net metering. There's another one going through the legislature now that will eliminate a cap on how much you can sell back. It's a great bill from Senator Hansen. I'm strongly supportive of it. If you have questions about solar and are looking for solar incentives, I don't know about you, Shirley or Tom. I have my neighbor across the street got solar. He swears by it. I don't think he's had a single power bill above $100 in the last year, $100 a month in the last year. I know there was some trouble with the ice covering it for a week. There are some, some things that happen with snow sometimes, but by and large, I encourage people to look at solar. We're also working harder than ever. In 2024, Delmarva Power approved zero community solar projects. Last year, I believe we got them to approve 14, and we're trying to more than double that this year. Community solar is something that will enable people that live in apartments or somewhere where rooftop solar may not be like realistic to still access community solar. Yeah, people in urban areas like Wilmington.
Okay.
But I encourage people, sorry, Sherry, to interrupt. I encourage people, anyone that has questions about this, is interested in incentives to weatherize their home to protect it because it's not just solar, please go to energizedelaware.org.
Okay. So want to shift gears here. You recently honored 125 years of Delaware libraries by announcing March 12th becoming Delaware Libraries Day. Libraries recently received a big chunk of one-time federal funds to build and expand, but they now face challenges. Here's State Librarian Annie Norman talking with Tom last week.
So the state provided all this ARPA funding that, you know, came from the feds, which was fantastic. But now we need operating funds to help keep the doors open. Funding is always an issue, and especially with all of the construction, it's like no good deed goes unpunished.
So last week, Sussex County started discussing the potential of raising its library tax, and Newcastle County is talking about cutting library hours as it faces a budget deficit. Does the state have more room in its budget to help address this issue?
So James and Deborah Fallows, in one of my favorite books, Our Towns, they said something happened in America in the past generation or two, and something particularly happened in small towns across America, small towns that are dotting the landscape across Delaware, and the majority of Delawareans live in these small towns. And something happened, and there was a divide where some towns in America, after all the economic change through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, really are thriving, and other towns are not thriving. And in the book, Our Towns, they concluded that one of the biggest differentiators between the towns that are thriving and the towns that are not are public libraries. That a public library, it's a community commons where people come together, and it's both a resource for the community and a symbol, a representation of a community that's coming together around organizing and coalescing around literacy and education. As anyone who's seen my career through county government knows, running the state's largest library system, you will not find a stronger believer and supporter than libraries. In terms of the rubber hitting the road and budgeting, we're working to find resources for libraries to sustain them. It's extremely challenging. It's sort of the budgetary challenge, one of the big budgetary challenges of this time. In almost every space, almost all these questions in some ways are the same question, whether it's healthcare, whether it's libraries, whether it's education. There was a huge rush of federal funding, COVID funding, that was great. And now that COVID funding is drying up, what are we going to do? We're going to find a way. We're going to get our pencils sharp and make sure there are resources there so that libraries don't close and libraries are available to the public.
Is it important that the state try to take a lead role in that and not necessarily have the weight fall on counties, municipalities?
Listen, I think it's important counties carry their weight. I think it's important municipalities carry their weight. I think it's important that we don't get in a situation where communities that are under-resourced get lower quality library services. Like one of my proudest accomplishments is the Route 9 library, which my predecessor county executive, Tom Gordon, was really his prize project, along with Councilman Jay Street and others. They turned it into reality, and we took it and made sure it got appropriate investment so the community could cherish it. We're going to look to make sure that libraries across our community continue to be valued. I think it's important that local governments and local people continue to make serious investments.
Okay, we want to turn to another new segment we're launching tonight, Accountability Corner. A listener wrote in expressing skepticism about a recent trade mission you took to India. Your office cited a number of wins that would bring, quote, new innovative opportunities to Delawareans. So can you make the case that these international trips are worth the taxpayer dollars?
Yeah, you know, this is my first trip, and I am as skeptical as anyone about these international trips. And for that reason, we went there, and I'd never been to India before. I would have loved to tour and see India. We did just about none of that. We were in three large cities. We had incredible meetings. We announced a major deal for Versigen, a small Delaware company, a University of Delaware technology that now is going to be involved in solar power and hydrogen technology that's going to be sold across India, a country of 1.5 billion people, almost four times by population the size of the United States. We have businesses that are going to be visiting us in the coming weeks who do medical health transport, who do advanced environmental energy work. In 2 weeks, I'm going to be meeting with 15 businesses. We had, just based on the number of companies that expressed interest in incorporating in Delaware, that alone more than paid for the cost of the trip.
Okay. We are going to, before we say goodnight, hit you with our final listener roundup of the evening. Okay. Danielle in Kent County says, Delaware is one of the leading states in foreclosure numbers. What is being done at the state level to aid homeowners?
We have provided historic funding, again, at this challenging time where housing got a huge amount of COVID funds, and those funds are falling off. We're finding a way in our state to increase our funding for the Delaware State Housing Authority to prevent foreclosure. There are housing counselors available. I encourage anyone who's facing or in fear of foreclosure to go to the Delaware State Housing Authority website and see the wealth of services and supports available to you. But listen, the bottom line is we need to bring down housing prices. That's mm-hmm. more challenging than ever. The country's at war. Mortgage rates are spiking. We're doing what we can here by making sure that we're working with local governments to expand housing opportunities to both renovate existing houses that have gone out of use and to build new housing in more dense environments that provides higher quality, lower cost housing for everyone.
Okay, Andrew from Bear says, I've seen many instances where dangerous driving is reported multiple times, but seen little visible enforcement or follow-up. What specific steps is your administration taking to make roads safer?
So there are a few things. First of all, speeding is a major problem. We're working on an initiative today that's going to dramatically expand the enforcement of speeding across our state. If you know of a specific area or road in which there is consistent dangerous driving, please make sure to contact your local representative, your county or city council member, your state representative or state senator, and we do not say no. We work hard to make sure there's additional policing and enforcement, and in some cases, with our transportation agency, DelDOT, we'll make changes to the road network or the, you know, one ways, the direction in which people go. One other thing to add is we are regularly monitoring where the most dangerous intersections and areas are based on data, and we're constantly working to update those areas just to make them safer for everyone.
Okay, real quick. Listener Newcastle wondering if you have any influence on getting Norwegian cruise lines to stop in Delaware so that residents can sail to Canada or the Bahamas.
There has been interest over the years to bring a cruise line to Wilmington. We have not worked on that. If there's significant public interest in doing so, we'll look at it. But I have no into Norwegian cruise lines. I will say, I mean, jokes aside, we, the last 14 months, since I was sworn in as governor, have been among the most the hardest 14 months economically for our country in terms of lack of predictability, in terms of having tariffs one day, the next day there are no tariffs, in terms of the federal government. You know, I mentioned the end of the COVID funds and challenges that state government's having. Now we're at war, gas prices are spiking, commodity, natural gas prices, oil prices. In that setting, our state, our little state of Delaware, has added 80 companies. 80 companies have either decided to expand operations here or come to Delaware, creating nearly 4,000 jobs that they've announced are going to, many have been created, some are going to be created, nearly $6 billion investment. Large companies like Merck doing biopharma curing cancer, companies like Qnity, which is a DuPont spinoff that's doing leading work in semiconductors and all sorts of other financial services. Upstart, a leading financial services firm in Silicon Valley, recently announced they're setting up a headquarters in Delaware. It's an exciting time to be in Delaware.
Okay, Governor, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a lively discussion. Thank you to all of our audience members who participated. And Governor Matt Meyer of Delaware, thank you for joining us.
Ask Governor Meyer is produced by Hazel Mae Bryan with help from Andreas Copes, Tina Calique, and Diana Martinez are our technical engineers. Thank you to Delaware Public Media's Ben Taboutier and Thomas Terry. Kevin McCrory is our executive producer. Joan Isabella is our audio general manager.
I'm Tom Byrne from Delaware Public Media.
And I'm Shirley Min. Thank you so much for joining us.